Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Remember that bestseller from the 90s, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus? Well, Mars, of course, is the god of war, and in much of the world since time immemorial, it's been the image men project or that society projects upon them. Tough, dangerous when provoked, impervious to deep feeling. Trouble is, many men, just like many women, suffer from anxiety, sadness, or depression. But all their friends and loved ones might see is an angry jerk or a guy with a drinking problem. This hour on Point, how anxiety looks in a man and how to help him face it and fix it. And you can join us. Is this you? Do you try to fit into a masculine mold and don't know how to cope with emotional stress without looking weak? Is this your friend or your spouse? Are we making progress in teaching boys how to be fine young men, but in touch with their emotions and how to be honest about them? Well, joining me in the studio today are two researchers who've studied anxiety in men. Michael Addis is professor of psychology and director of the Men's Wellbeing Research Group at Clark University. He's author of Invisible Men, Men's Inner Lives and the Consequences of Silence. Michael Addis, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Stefan Hoffman. He's professor in the clinical program at Boston University, where he directs the Psychotherapy and Emotion Research Laboratory. He's also affiliated with Boston University's Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, and he has a forthcoming book titled The Anxiety Skills Workbook. Stefan Hoffman, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start by reading to both of you one of the comments that has already come in to our website about this topic. It's from Mike L. And Mike L. writes, "The first girlfriend I cried quietly in the presence of stopped being my girlfriend shortly thereafter. It's the reason my father didn't cry in front of us. It's the reason his father didn't cry at all. This isn't toxic masculinity. This is our culture." So, Michael Addis, let me start with you. How indicative of is what Mike L. is saying about what you've seen in your research about men and anxiety?
Well, I think Mike is put his finger on one of the sort of most common messages that men get. It's in the air everywhere that we need to, keep our feelings to ourselves and put on that sort of stoic, tough man, stiff upper lip orientation to things. I'm not sure that every woman out there is necessarily having a problem with that or punishing the expression of emotion, but it's certainly a cultural mandate, and we've seen it again and again in our research interviews with men who are struggling with issues of anxiety or depression.
Well, Stefan, Mike actually goes on to write. He says, "Gentlemen, it's fine to share your feelings with friends and family, but give them an abridged version with no displays of visceral emotion. People you know tend to internalize things you tell them. They suffix your revelations with a 'how this affects me.'" And then Mike says it'll even be used against you if there's a perception of hypocrisy on your part later on. You're better off seeking a professional or clergyman and letting no one know if you do. Hmm. What do you think about that?
Yeah, again, this is very much in our culture to have this sort of approach toward emotions and to suppress emotions, and we know that this is a very maladaptive approach. So being restrictive and inflexible and not showing emotions and sharing emotions can be quite bad for your mental health.
Mm. Well, so let's sort of take a step back here and I'd like to get a sense from both of you regarding anxiety specifically. Michael Addis, I mean, do we know how prevalent it is among men?
Yeah, well, we know that. So anxiety is extremely common in human beings in general. And in fact, yeah, we'd be in a boatload of trouble if we didn't have the capacity for anxiety. It's really our body's way of telling us that there's a threat that we need to pay attention to. But of course, with an anxiety disorder, there often is not a real threat, and instead our body is responding as if there is. So that's the challenge. We know that men, compared to women, are about half as likely to be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. But of course, the big question for people who do research in this field is that really an accurate estimate? Or are some of these cultural mandates that, that Stefan was talking about, particularly for men, around suppressing fear and vulnerability and, like Mike is saying, keeping it to myself, is that distorting our understanding? In other words, we're underestimating how common this is amongst men.
Well, Professor Hoffman, what do you think about that?
Yeah. Anxiety is a very broad construct. So without getting too much into detail, but we distinguish a lot of different categories of anxiety disorders. So social anxiety disorder is probably one of the most common ones. And there's generalized anxiety disorder. There's specific phobias and other types and so it depends on the categories. We know that for social anxiety disorder, actually men are about equally affected than women. For generalized anxiety disorder, specific phobias, panic disorder, women are more commonly affected than men. Why that is a good question.
I was just going to ask that.
It's puzzling. There are probably social factors, cultural factors that play a role, and I'm sure we will be discussing these in more detail. There are also interesting differences in different cultures, especially in Asians versus Western cultures. There are differences in the expression and also the experience of anxiety.
Now, when we say diagnosed, does it rely on a person seeking out help of some kind? I mean, to arrive at a diagnosis for cases that aren't so extreme that, for example, hospitalization occurs? And you know where I'm going with this. Are men less likely to seek help and therefore maybe less likely to become diagnosed?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And the reality is that right now our technology is such that we don't have any ways to diagnose anxiety disorder short of people responding, yes, I have that symptom. Now, we do know that the estimates that that Stefan was talking about are based upon – they're not dependent upon people seeking help. These are estimates that are based upon, you know, cold calling large samples of people across the country. But yes, when you're talking about individuals in your life, you know, someone has to be able to recognize in themselves even that they're experiencing anxiety, fear, stress, and that it's getting in the way. In order for that to become public, you know, forget going to a doctor, but just to someone that you know, to friends and family members.
And when you say I am experiencing these symptoms, right, that we map to various anxiety disorders, what symptoms are those?
Well, it depends on the type of anxiety problem you're experiencing. But in general, so if the problem is distressing enough and interfering with your daily lives, then we often – it meets the threshold for a disorder that requires clinical attention. The symptoms vary for people with social anxiety. They obviously are related to fear of negative evaluation by others, of avoiding going to parties and meeting new people and giving presentations. For people with generalized anxiety disorder, these are worrying about – they worry about minor matters, about jobs, about finances and the like. And so there are different types of anxiety disorders that are very specific for different symptoms.
Yeah. So the symptoms are one thing, but then how those symptoms are expressed perhaps might be another thing. Now look, we're not going to say that all men express anxiety in a certain way and all women express anxiety in a different way. But generally speaking, Michael Addis, do some men sort of express the symptoms of anxiety differently than what we might sort of commonly perceive as how it's experienced in women?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. And what I would say to that is that there does seem to be some clinical wisdom and a great deal of anecdotal evidence from people that work in mental health and from people that studies men's lives that when men struggle with fear and depression as well, it can tend to come out more as anger and aggression. That said, we don't as yet have definitive scientific evidence of that. But I can tell you, for example, anecdotally, one of the things that got me into this area of research was that I was working on an anxiety treatment center on a research study, and I ended up interviewing a man who was having daily panic attacks. And a panic attack is an overwhelming sense of anxiety and fear that comes on very quickly. You can be dizzy, nauseous, have a sense of unreality. But here's the kicker. He was actually a construction worker working up on those scaffolds, you know, 30 stories up in the air and having daily panic attacks. And it's been going on for 10 years and he had not sought treatment because he felt that this was a weakness on his part, that if he had more character, or I might say if he had more sort of masculinity as socially defined, he would have been, he thought in his own mind, able to deal with that and conquer it.
Professor Hoffman, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. The it's very much of a socialization issue, men in our culture are more encouraged to use, let's say, strategies such as substance use, alcohol, to suppress their emotions or to act out emotions in an aggressive way that's more socially acceptable as compared to women. They are more encouraged to talk to their friend and to bottle it up and to perhaps kind of withdraw and become passive. So this is very much in line with how do we regulate our emotions in a culturally adaptive way. And so that's what the essence is.
Well, so just to put a fine point on it, there was an article from the Wall Street Journal a while ago that quoted Kevin Chapman, a clinical psychologist in Louisville, Kentucky, who said that anxious men may present as loose cannons, but they are warriors, that aggression tends to be more socially acceptable to many men than anxiety. So we're going to explore that a little bit more when we come back, because we are talking about men and anxiety. And I'm joined today by Michael Addison, Stefan Hoffman, and we want to hear from you. Is this something that strikes a familiar chord in you or someone that you love? And what's preventing men from getting the kind of help they need, and how can we help them? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about men and anxiety. And I'm joined today by Michael Addis. He's a professor of psychology and director of the Men's Wellbeing Research Group at Clark University, author of Invisible Men, Men's Inner Lives and the Consequences of Silence. Stefan Hoffman also joins us today. He's professor in the clinical program at Boston University, where he directs the Psychotherapy and Emotion Research Laboratory. And let's go to Daniel, who's calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me. So I'm 25 years old, and I started dealing with anxiety about 2 years ago when I was 23. And prior to that, I had never experienced any sort of anxiety. And that actually made it more difficult for me to talk to people, because the people who the people who were closest to me, who had known me for the longest, sort of dismissed it when I told them that, wow, I'm experiencing this very crippling anxiety, and I didn't know how to deal with it. And for me, it manifested in panic attacks. I just had very intense panic attacks in which I would cry, I would break down, I would just kind of be immobile. The one person I felt like I could talk to at the time was my girlfriend. Mm-hmm. I just started dating someone new, and I started using her as my source of comfort, which in hindsight was a terrible thing, because once that relationship ended, I had no one there for me.
Yeah. Daniel, hang on here for a second. Don't hang up, because actually I want you to know that both Michael Addis and Stefan Hoffman are nodding their heads in agreement here. So, Daniel, don't hang up. But Michael Addis, let me start with you. What do you hear in what Daniel's saying?
I hear a lot in what Daniel's saying. I hear things that I've heard before from many men. One of the themes is that anxiety is unfortunately like a lot of words in psychology. It's one that we use every day. So a lot of times when people disclose that they're dealing with anxiety, those around them may not realize the severity of what we're talking about. This is not, you know, everyday worry. This is when it gets to the point where it's really troubling you. The other thing I notice is that, you know, one of the, from my perspective, tragedies of men's mental health is that across the board, men are less likely than women to talk to other people in their lives about problems. Mm. And as a result, people don't often know the degree to which others are suffering. And so it can seem unusual, more unusual than it actually is.
But in Daniel's case, Daniel said that he did turn to his girlfriend, which, Daniel, you said in retrospect it wasn't a good idea. Why is that?
No, just because I became dependent on her. Uh-huh. In order to, as a person to talk to and someone that I could cry to and be vulnerable around. And when that relationship ultimately ended, I just felt like I had sort of lost my rock, my stronghold, the one thing that sort of kept me going.
Well, I want to hear what Stefan Hoffman has to say about that.
Yeah, this is very much of an example of how you try to regulate your emotions through another person, and that sort of left you dependent on her, and that is obviously it's in a way it's normal that we always do that. When we feel emotional, we want to be around other people. We want to bounce off our feelings off of these people. The problem is that when one individual has such a key role in relieving distress, then it becomes a real issue. And so in this case, I would even call her as something like a safety behavior, safety person. This is sort of a person you can be around with and things will be okay. But once this person is gone, then you're in big trouble.
Yeah. Daniel, how are you doing today?
I'm better. I've just been keeping myself busy. The anxiety really started around the time that I was graduating from college, and I didn't have any clear career goals in mind. I actually graduated with a degree in psychology, and I come from a very successful family. My father's a physician. One of my brothers works in tech. One of my brothers works for a bank, and I just had no idea what I was doing with my life. And I think I just felt kind of extreme pressure. But at this point, I have a job. I'm playing organized sports. I'm taking piano lessons. I'm just trying to set small goals for myself that I can accomplish every day. And overall, I'm doing better.
Yeah.
It's just, you just need to take things one step at a time.
Well, Daniel, first of all, I'm glad to hear that you're doing better. And thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. Michael Addis, I was in listening to the things that Daniel says he's done to help improve his mental health. They're very admirable, right? He was talking about setting smaller goals for himself, playing organized sports. These are all kind of concrete, actionable things. I didn't necessarily hear him say, maybe because he didn't want to share it, I don't know, that he's seeing a mental health professional. Is there a difference in approach that works for some men when it comes to like trying to do things to actually help improve their situation?
Well, I think there's a variety of approaches to effectively dealing with anxiety for all people. So at this point, we don't know, we can't point to one treatment and say this is more effective for men, although there are some studies showing that on average, although men are different from each other, on average, males tend to prefer more action-oriented approaches to therapy, which is what you might expect, less sort of digging into childhood emotions and things like that. But in general, one of the good things about anxiety disorders is that they're effectively treatable.
Mm.
and you've got one of the world's experts in the treatment of anxiety sitting right next to me.
Well, right. I mean, Professor Hoffman, tell us more about this. And I also just note that you have this forthcoming book out about cognitive behavioral therapy as well. But your thoughts on I've read that, for example, for some men, like the coaching model mm-hmm. of therapy seems to be quite effective.
Yeah. So, you know, so let me just start out by saying, yes, cognitive behavioral therapy is by far the most effective form of intervention for emotional disorders, including anxiety disorders. And it's a very broad term that there's a sort of an umbrella term for different treatment strategies that work. And we're moving more and more in the direction of trying to figure out what is most effective for the individual rather than having one size fits all approach. And this is also what Michael already alluded to. So we really need to be mindful of what is it that that brings people in this misery and figuring out this right strategies to move the person. Your caller did suggest that some behavioral interventions he already did on his own, and many of these strategies are quite effective. Behavioral intervention is quite effective, and perhaps this is why it worked for Daniel so well. Perhaps with the right coach and with the right therapist, one could maybe even come up with additional strategies to help him along.
Is it useful to talk about it in terms of coaching versus therapy? Because I imagine there are many men who men and women, but since we're focusing on men, who may just say, "Well, this is something that I need to tackle by myself," and so the idea of even seeking help from a therapist or a mental health professional, that's a bridge too far.
If that's what it takes to break the ice, to open up the door of, okay, I have somebody else, let somebody else help me. That if that's what it takes to reframe, to find new terms for something, don't call it therapy, call it coaching, don't call it intervention, call it strategy, that would be fine. Hmm.
Now, I want to just ask both of you, I mean, there are so many reasons why this is very important to talk about, but I wanted to explore a set of research that really surprised me, that there seems to be an emerging link between more research is finding a link between anxiety and suicide. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, one thing we've known for several decades is that men take their lives at about four times the rate that women do. Mm. And, suicide is often set in motion by, regardless of the mental disorder that might be or might not be surrounding it, it's set in motion by a sort of narrowing of vision, a hopelessness, the sense that things are not going to get better. The idea that the air that men breathe on a large scale, which creates these mandates for handling problems on your own, being a success, always keeping your weaknesses to yourself and so on, it's not hard to see how that would heighten that sense of hopelessness if you are in fact facing something like chronic anxiety. So there's certainly a link there, not to mention the fact that correct me if I'm wrong, Stefan, but I believe the rates of anxiety disorders, there's some evidence that they're increasing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. And if I could just add on, I think that the cases that you alluded to is particularly evident when you look at the returning veterans from Iraq. Mm-hmm. We have a serious suicide crisis that people don't want to talk about because talking about suicide leads to suicide. But there is a serious crisis of suicide among veterans, returning veterans. More people are dying of suicide than in combat at this point. Mm-hmm. So this is a tragedy that is obviously linked to also the way people deal with these strong emotions, finding no way to resolve that, and at the same time having this easy access to guns, and that is a huge tragedy that we need to tackle.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to ask both of you to stand by for just a moment because I want to introduce into the conversation Mark Farley, who joins us from Houston, Texas. When he was a student at Rhodes College, Mark founded an on-campus chapter of Active Minds, a mental health advocacy group, and he became a peer advocate as well. Mark Farley, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, Mark, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to tell us about just sort of your experience with anxiety or mental health challenges.
Sure. So I've been experiencing anxiety really since elementary school. When you look at the way society kind of views grades, they view achievements and success. A lot of pressure is now put on kids growing up. And so I suffer from anxiety from really elementary school till high school. At age 17, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which made treating the anxiety a whole lot more difficult because, as one of y'all pointed out, the anxiety kind of narrows that focus and it leads to despair and leads to hopelessness. And I've unfortunately had my share of both, and it's accumulated with a bunch of attempts because really not talking about what's going on, not allowing myself to be vulnerable, not willing to accept or even process the anxieties or the depression that, I'm experiencing led to, grave consequences.
Mm. And Mark, those consequences being what?
Consequences being throughout majority of my undergraduate career, I used sleep medicine to pretty much get from day to day, trying to escape or try and change or fix the anxieties that I was going through. And in reality, by trying to escape those feelings, it actually made them significantly worse. Mm-hmm. And over time, when you, ignore the feelings that you're experiencing, eventually those feelings can become so severe, so heavy, mm-hmm. that there's really, at least in my mind at those times, there was really nothing that I thought would be able to fix it or alleviate it. And so I thought the best avenue of choice then would be to attempt or kill myself.
Mm. Mm. Mark, this is breaking my heart to hear this, but we're talking to you because you founded an on-campus chapter of Active Minds. So tell us what got you to this point where thankfully you were not successful in your attempts to take your own life, but instead you became proactive.
Correct. Yeah. So Active Minds is a nonprofit organization dedicated to utilizing the student voice to raise mental health awareness on college and high school campuses. And they strive to both educate students about mental health, like anxiety, in order to kind of dispel the stigma that's associated with it, create a judgment-free atmosphere, and kind of open a conversation about subjects that we as a society don't really like talking about. And one of the things that Active Minds and, working with the organization and programming activities really showed me was that it's okay to be vulnerable, that you're not the only person that is suffering from anxiety or depression, mm-hmm. or bipolar disorder or suicidal ideation, and that in reality, silence truly hurts us all. Like, if I'm not being honest and talking about what I'm going through, whether it's with a friend, a significant other, a family member, or a treatment provider, it makes my life a whole lot more difficult.
Yeah.
And so by being able to show people, by being able to show students that, especially men, that it's okay to be vulnerable, it's okay to talk about your feelings. Like, it's nothing against, one's masculinity. I mean, the concept of masculinity is kind of toxic right now. And so when you're able to kind of step aside and take a step back and look at everything that's going on, just being able to create you know, a conversation on a college campus where the majority of men are, you know, some are using alcohol, some are using drugs, sex, over-exercising, eating, in order to try and cope with those anxieties, showing them that they're not by themselves and that there are multiple different options and avenues in which that they can proceed in treatment or even talk about mm-hmm. anxiety is huge.
Yeah. Mark, hang on here for just a second. Michael Addis, let me turn back to you, because one of the things that Mark is saying here that really rings true in my head is that Active Minds, it's a peer group model for reaching men who might be suffering. We can't just expect people to sort of walk into the counseling center on campus when they're in need of help. So is this an effective way to reach them?
Well, I congratulate Mark on his efforts, and I'm really glad he's doing this kind of work. And as you might suspect, you know, as someone who looks at this from a more cultural angle, it is exactly the silence that goes on in peer groups that creates a widespread misperception that everybody else is okay. So if I'm struggling and no one else is talking about their anxiety or their depression, this just adds to my sense of isolation. In contrast, if you do the sorts of efforts that Mark is spearheading here, then you have groups of men seeing that this is actually quite much more common than you would think. I mean, we actually did one study that found that both men and women underestimate the percentage of men who want to talk about what's going on in their lives.
Interesting.
So we call this pluralistic ignorance in psychology.
Well, we have to take a quick break. Mark Farley, I'm going to say goodbye to you, but thank you so much for joining us. Mark was, when he was a student at Rhodes College, he founded an on-campus chapter of Active Minds, a mental health advocacy group. He also became a peer advocate as well. Mark, thank you again for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
We are talking about men and anxiety. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about men and anxiety, and I'm joined today by Michael Addis. He's a professor of psychology and director of the Men's Wellbeing Research Group at Clark University. Stefan Hoffman also joins us. He's a professor in the clinical program at Boston University, where he directs the Psychotherapy and Emotion Research Laboratory. We've got calls coming in from Maine, Massachusetts, New York, Michigan, and Nebraska, just for starters. So let's go to Walter, who is calling from Bangor, Maine. Walter, you're on the air.
Hi. I would like to bring a different perspective to this discussion. Your panel was talking about men not talking so much about their issues concerning anxiety and depression. I'm an emergency room physician, and I'm certainly not a researcher, but I have been on the front lines of this for many years, and I vehemently disagree that men don't come forward. They come forward as much or more than women with their issues. And I think the onus is much more on the listener. We don't talk about the listener at all.
Walter, I'm going to take it back from you there, because your cell phone is very hard to hear, and I apologize for that. But Stefan Hoffman, Walter there saying he's an emergency room physician. In his experience, at least, he's seeing men come in just as much, if not more, than women seeking help. But the question is, do the professionals that are treating these men recognize the kind of help they need, because perhaps the men are asking or they're presenting in different ways?
Yeah, that's possible. It's also possible that because of his profession, he's trained to listen to these individuals and has this perspective as a result. So, and we're obviously comparing women and men, there's a fairly good amount of research pointing to the clear difference that men are more isolated. They're more certainly in their kind of in the way they approach subject matter. That women are more forthcoming with sharing their emotional feelings with others. So I appreciate the caller's opinion, but it's quite possible that it's his perspective due to his profession.
Michael Addis, this makes me think, you know, right now in the culture, there's a lot of worthy discussion on this notion of toxic masculinity, right? And I wonder, could there be a potential, one of those unexpected, inadvertent outcomes of these important cultural discussions that, you know, when we see a man evincing the characteristics of toxic masculinity, might it make it harder for us to assess whether or not there's something else other than just, you know, this terrible form of maleness being expressed? You're like, this might actually be a person who's suffering.
Right. Well, I think one of the unfortunate byproducts of the widespread use of the term toxic masculinity is that people conflate masculinity with being male. And they're really two very different things. So masculinity is a set of ideas. Some people call it a performance. You know, this is a way of presenting oneself. Now, men as people are first and foremost human beings. And so men can experience a wide range of emotions and express them in a wide variety of different ways. So from that perspective, we absolutely want to bear in mind that when we see a man angry, you know, picking fights, maybe driving fast, gambling more than usual, any of these sorts of what we call externalizing presentations, we don't want to just write this off as, you know, nasty manhood. We want to see that there may well be significant issues underlying all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to Susan, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. As a teacher of very young children, early childhood, I'm wondering if there's anything the guests can suggest in order to head some of this stuff off, because I do see little boys acting tough, and you can pick, you know, if you really observe, you can see the anxiety already, even in young toddlers.
And if Susan, how do you see it? What are they doing that makes you see it?
Oh, they cling. They don't explore as much as, you know, they should developmentally. They're kind of overreactive. And overly fearful. And you can see this in very little children if you look. And I do see that boys kind of are more aggressive at this age than girls. And I'm just, you know, I mean, I see it. It's there.
Yeah.
Is there any way to work with parents or something that we can do in the classroom to try to head this off from being a lifetime problem?
Susan, thank you so much for your call. Stefan Hoffman, do you have any advice
well,
for her?
Yeah, well, you know, there's what determines gender is obviously both a matter of biology as well as social influence. And there's no doubt that there is a difference in the sexes, in certain hormones, such as testosterone, that is associated with more aggressive behaviors. The issue is obviously when this kind of behavior negatively affects the social context, when this hurts other people, when it becomes a dominant issue. And so just the fact that males from the biological aspect are different from females in certain behaviors doesn't mean that it needs to be a maladaptive behavior. Mm. It can be channeled in the right way or in the wrong way.
But so, Michael Addis, how might a teacher like Susan do that in an elementary school classroom? Or, I mean, imagine all the parents listening to this, raising my hand right here. I mean, we are inculcating girls and boys from the time they're born with certain societal expectations. I mean, how do we counter that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, what I think a good maybe a good frame for thinking about that is that if you think about shifting the way we do gender as a culture, which is really what we're talking about here, what are we going to do in the classroom with these gendered processes that come up? You've got roughly two options. You can reconstruct or deconstruct. And reconstruct means you come up with a new, in this case, a new masculinity. So you could, for example, tell boys that, you know, being a real man means being kind to others and being respectful. And then you could sort of try to encourage that. The other option is to deconstruct, which is essentially to emphasize gender less. So school teachers, for example, are often not aware of the subtle things that they can do that are reinforcing the idea that boys should be boys and girls should be girls. Simply referring to students as boys and girls, for example, rather than students, reinforces that dichotomy. I think the ultimately the common pathway you're looking for is modeling healthy emotional expression amongst the boys. You know, there's actually evidence that young boys, and I'm talking about, you know, birth to 18 months, are more emotionally responsive than young girls at a physiological level. But somehow by middle school, we've gotten rid of all of that, and we've turned them into sort of more the stoic, tough guys. That can be brought back, and it won't go as far away if you bring into the classroom regular opportunities for discussing relationships, difficult feelings, and so on.
Interesting. And even at that age, the pressure between peers is quite intense. I mean, I remember in my own parenting journey, which continues, when one of my kids was in as young as second grade, I noticed that she was coming home saying, you know, what friends groups were saying to each other about how boys were supposed to react to something versus girls. I mean, that's for like a 7-year-old. So, and that's between the peers. So how do we overcome that?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. Kids grow up and develop to be with their peers, not to be with their parents. So I've been through the same thing. We can put out whatever message or ideology we want there, but ultimately they model what they see amongst other kids. Fortunately, we do have some influence as teachers and parents, and the more we attune ourselves to how these processes play out, the more opportunities we're going to see. You know, I teach a psychology of men class twice a year to undergraduates, and the one consistent thing I hear is they had no idea how common these processes were of the policing of masculinity and the punishing and the shutting down of emotion. And now that they're aware of it, they're more in a position to act and do things differently.
Well, let's go to Heather, who's calling from Keene, New York. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Go ahead, Heather.
Great. So I'm actually going to change track from what my original question was. So I'm actually going to ask about my son, who is 18. He is he just graduated from high school, and he's taking a gap year. And he did reach out to me in the spring and mentioned to me that he thought he might have bipolar disorder. However, he does not want to talk to anybody about it. So I'm not sure what the best course of action is for me as a mother.
Well, Heather, thank you for your call. Stefan, do you have an answer for her?
Yeah, I'd like to figure out to why he doesn't want to talk to people. So I think there's obviously something holding him back. There's a reason why he wants to be sort of in isolation, and I think this is an important role that you have as a mother to help him with this very important step to actually then acknowledge it and then seek some help.
Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. A while back, you had a show on friendship and how many more friends women have than men. And I'm wondering if men's lack of friends, that lack of social support, contributes to the cause and responses to anxiety.
Jim, thank you for your call. Michael Addis, social groups?
I think Jim is spot on. We know, for example, that that men tend to, on average, fare worse following divorce. And one of the contributors to that is that we tend to have smaller social networks of people that we can rely on. And like one of our first callers, I believe, we put all of our emotional eggs in one basket, which in a heterosexual relationship is often the woman. And often, you know, even when men do have friends that they see regularly, that, you know, there's a difference between people you see regularly and people who truly know you,
mm-hmm.
The real you. And I think there's just an overwhelming amount of evidence that the degree of social support in people's lives is related to their emotional and their social well-being. So it's I think he's hit the nail on the head there.
Stefan Hoffman, did you want to add to that?
Yeah. So the biggest predictor of any psychopathology is loneliness. Being lonely, being isolated from a social network is most toxic.
Network in real life, I should say.
Certainly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, in fact, Facebook is a network that does not actually encourage social connectedness, to the opposite. So you want to have a few very close friends. You don't really want to have a lot of kind of friends. That's not helpful at all.
Yeah, to the point that Michael is making, people who authentically know you.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, let's go to Gary, who's calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Gary, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Just wanted to say that I'm a retired firefighter with law enforcement background, so I've seen a lot of things. And in that position, we compartmentalize. We put things in a box at the moment, or we could not function to do our job.
Mm-hmm.
And the warning that I have for people is if you compartmentalize, you might make it through that for a while, but eventually those feelings are going to come out. And when they do, they can be expressed in abnormal risk-taking, abuse of alcohol, spousal abuse, just things that you just don't want to do. So my advice is try to talk to people if you can. I can see the expressions on people's faces when I tell them what I've seen and been through. And so you can tell it hurts them. But try to find somebody that you can express what's going on with your mind or within yourself, because when it comes out, it's generally not good.
Yeah. Gary, thank you so much for your call. Michael and Stefan, Gary imploring people to reach out. I wonder what advice you might give for folks on the other side of that equation, that when they believe that there's a man in their life that may need help, how to approach that.
Well, I think I think the first thing to keep in mind is that when you're concerned about someone in your life based on their mental health or emotional health, is you want to keep focused on your concern and your love, if you do love this person, and your compassion, and lead with that, as opposed to perhaps the also reasonable frustration you might have, particularly if you've been imploring them to seek help for some time. So I often encourage people to let men know that that you're concerned and why you're concerned, but also not to expect an immediate response, because if getting help or even talking to another person about mental health issues is a really difficult prospect, some men are going to be understandably resistant to doing that and might blow you off, might roll their eyes and so on. But, and this is the big caveat, it doesn't mean that they didn't hear you.
Mm.
And I think it's very important, particularly for men who are isolated and lonely, to know that those around them care and are available, even if they also are respecting your decision not to get help at this point.
Stefan Hoffman, your thoughts on that?
Yeah. And as your caller suggested, it is very important simply to talk and to find like-minded people you can share this. What you don't want to do is bottle things up. And your caller also correctly noted, sometimes in situations, in those high-risk, high-danger, high-risk situations, that's what people do. They dissociate. They are just performing their act and try not to be influenced by what's happening. But then it's important to actually integrate what this experience.
Well, Stefan Hoffman is professor in the clinical program at Boston University, where he directs the Psychotherapy and Emotion Research Laboratory. He's author of a forthcoming book, The Anxiety Skills Workbook. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Michael Addis, professor of psychology and director of the Men's Well-Being Research Group at Clark University and author of Invisible Men, Men's Inner Lives and the Consequences of Silence. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.